Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the battle over who marches on St. Patrick's Day rages in newsrooms across Boston. We'll ask if you think it matters as much as we do. Then Globe editor Brian McGrory joins us to discuss big changes at the Globe and big salaries in Boston. Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan. Do e-cigarettes make it more or less likely that teens will smoke the real ones? And will those expanded nutrition labels on food actually do any good?
Folk legend Judy Collins joins us in studio. Can't wait. And teens turn stressed out human achievement machines as mom and dad push harder and harder to get them into good colleges. All that coming up next on 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
So Judy Collins is going to be in studio in an hour.
I am really excited.
In the interim, the St. Patrick's Day Parade doesn't get a rest. You just heard it. It's been spun around the news cycle for the last week, and the latest development is dizzying. Now, organizers of the parade have rescinded their invitation to the gay rights organization Mass Equality. They've also cut off negotiations to end the longstanding ban on gay groups. So we want to know from you at 877-301-8970. Is this as big a deal to you as it is in newsrooms throughout New England? Or is it the media outside of the world that matters most to you? Is it important to Boston and Boston's reputation? Our number is 877-301-8970. If you're sick of hearing about the parade, you can feel free to make your case here. And you can make that case whether you're for inclusion of mass equality or against inclusion. It's just gotten huge play on television and in the newspaper. And I have to say, I think well-deserved. Huge. This is, as Marty Walsh said the other day, it is 2014, Marjorie. There's a Washington Post poll this morning to me that is staggering. 59% of people in the 50 states and District of Columbia support gay marriage. Yet in South Boston, in Massachusetts, gays can't march. And a St. Patrick's Day parade, it's almost an out-of-body experience.
Well, there's something that is upsetting the idea that celebrating Irish culture kind of demands that you leave out gays, I think, is an insult to lots of Irish Americans or people in Ireland who have in 2014 moved beyond this as well. I mean, there are many polls in Ireland showing the support for gays and lesbians there is huge. And in fact, the support for gay marriage is the Irish Examiner did a poll, said it was more than a majority, I think 73%. So that's number one, that is kind of saying that, you know, if we're going to celebrate Irish culture, we have to get rid of gays, or that this is a Catholic thing. And many Catholics, as a matter of fact, polls show that most Catholics now are supportive of gay marriage. So the idea that this is an Irish Catholic event and we have to exclude gays, I think hurts both Catholics and Irish Americans, whether you ever go to the parade or not. So that's a part of it. And there's also this very militaristic side of the parade.
Meaning what?
Well, sometimes they have tanks and personnel carriers and everybody's in uniform. And the fact that the Veterans for Peace can't march either because their theme is, well, we fought and served our country in wars and work for peace now, they're excluded too. So it's got this overly militaristic tone, which is upsetting as well. I think it's embarrassing to Boston.
But are we giving it too much? I am almost exactly where you are. So let's assume that that's where the two of us are. Some people, as we learned when we talked about this a few days ago, are in a totally different place in our audience. But the threshold issue for today is, are we giving too much attention to this issue? It's just a parade. It's a parade. Everybody agrees that when Wacko Hurley is gone, the lead organizer, it's going to change. Hopefully it'll change in whatever it is, 10 or 11 days. If it doesn't and doesn't change next year, as Marty Walsh, the mayor, says, just a couple of guys who are standing in the way. Well, when the couple of guys are gone, it's going to be gone. The ban is going to be gone. That's the worst case scenario. So are we making too much about this?
I don't think we're making too much about it because Wacko Hurley, unfortunately, becomes sort of the face of Boston every St. Patrick's Day. And it's it's Boston is associated with the Irish. Boston is associated with Catholics. Boston is associated with a long history. South Boston is associated with a history, fair or unfair, going back to busing. And it just paints a picture of Boston that is unwelcoming. What does this say? We spend thousands of dollars. The city of Boston spends thousands of dollars because it's a parade. And to a certain degree,
hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, that's what some people claim. It's $400,000. I'm not sure if that figure is accurate or not, but that's a lot of money to spend supporting a parade that excludes a whole group of people.
Well, in all fairness, they would say the mayor would say, I think. It's not supporting the parade. It's making sure that people are safe. Just if, you know, if anybody.
And they have to. I mean, we all know if Nazis marching in Skokie and all that kind of stuff.
Right, there'd be cops for that too.
There'd be cops for that too. But I think it's just upsetting to me that Boston gets railroaded year after year by this tiny, tiny group of Allied war veterans. And it is a tiny group. It's four of them, five of them, maybe six of them, that they seem to have this lock hold on what's become not a celebration of Irish culture, but sort of a celebration of exclusion.
Yeah, but you keep making the argument, which I agree with, that it is an inappropriate thing.
No, we are not.
But by giving it as much play as we and the Globe and the Herald are giving, are we essentially we're bootstrapping ourselves into the situation where we're helping to create the bad image when, as you say, it's one guy or two guys.
Let me get to your question then. When you write about this or you talk about this, the response is huge. So I would say there's a lot of upset.
Do you see the number of comments in your story, by the way, about South? There were more than 500 on the Herald website, which
is huge. Which is a lot of comments. So I think the response is huge on both sides. Those people who say, from South Boston, leave our parade alone. We got a 9-0. As a matter of fact, I just got an email from Steve on Plum Island who's saying there's a 9-0 Supreme Court decision regarding who can be invited to the parade.
Oh, they clearly can exclude
and they
anybody they want.
They absolutely can exclude anybody
yes, they
want. So you get people that say that, and you get people on the other side saying they, too, are embarrassed by this whole fiasco every year. So I think there's a lot of passion around the St. Patrick's Day.
You know what I'm embarrassed by? I have to say, well, we celebrate Pope Francis here practically every single day. And remember the infamous or famous comment he made on that plane press conference saying, who am I to judge? Brother Thomas Dalton, he's head of the head of the Immaculate Heart of Mary School from Central Massachusetts. They're not going to have their band in float in the parade. They've been marching there for years if a great group is allowed to march. Here's what he had to say. They're from Harvard, Mass. Here's what he had to say about the parade on NECN a couple of nights ago.
Homosexual movement, the people are getting fed up with it. I mean, how much do we have to take? It's hitting us everywhere we go, and I think people don't want that to be forced on them.
You know, and he goes on to say, in the great column, you wrote a great column the other day, Kevin Cullum wrote a great one in the Globe, too, in which he quotes the same Brother Thomas as saying, Roman Catholic teaches that homosexual acts are acts of grave depravity and intrinsically disordered. I mean, it's actually staggering.
Did you see what we just had?
Well,
on our
screen? CNN is allegedly reporting that Pope Francis suggested church could support civil unions for gays. Can we see the story, you guys, in a couple of seconds? This is from this morning at 10 o'clock. So juxtapose that with Wacko Hurley banning a gay organization from marching in a parade. And by the way,
and juxtapose that with what this priest just said.
Very good point.
About homosexual acts. I mean, I think he's perhaps out of step with the pontiff.
And just for today's discussion, it is fine if you can't control yourself to argue the merits of this. It's fine on both sides. But we know the merits, and we'd like to talk at least a little bit about whether or not the press, in your estimation, is blowing this out of proportion. Marjorie and I don't think we are, but some of you may think we are. Let's go to Fall River first, hometown of Marjorie Egan, where Craig is on the phone. Hey, Craig.
Hi, how you doing?
We're excellent. Thank you for the call.
My thing is this. You know, if you are a private organization and have to pull a permit in order to have a parade, okay, you shouldn't be forced to have participants in it that you're not comfortable with.
Well, they're not being forced. No one can force them to do it.
Yeah, they can do whatever they want.
We agree.
They're getting pressured.
Yes, they are.
And you had brought it up earlier about the protection of the Nazis. Can you imagine if they were being pressured to have Jewish people parade with them? It's public pressure. And you're right. It is media exploiting the situation. You know, the Boston Parade, you keep saying Catholics and Irish. Well, Catholics and Irish have built this parade to what it is today. And now you're trying to force something in that has never been part of it.
By the way, what is the parade today? Essentially, what Kevin Cullen, who happens to be Irish and Catholic, in the Globe said, it's an opportunity for people to get smashed at bars. And if you go to the website, this is Kevin, not me. Kevin says when you go to the website, the official website of the parade, quote, the first thing you see is a link directing you to bars where you can celebrate your Irish heritage by having a few cold ones. I might be more inclined to accept the parade was all about honoring veterans if the website gave prominence to a link where people could donate their beer money to Wounded Warriors or Fisher House or home base. So, Craig, the reality is it's not some huge tribute to veterans, even though hopefully that's part of the day. It's an opportunity for people to have fun and have a drink and be together. I mean, isn't it really?
I understand that. I'm just saying, as a private organization,
you're right.
Who is
they can. You're right.
For the permitting.
Yes.
You know, they're entitled.
Now, yes,
you could take this a step further. You know, everyone is saying, "Oh, gay couples can't get married." Well, look, that's a state issue. Okay? It shouldn't have anything to do with the church. If the church wants to exclude gays, by all means, exclude them. But when it comes to marriage, now that has to do with the state. And
you're right. Craig, one last question. Craig, one last question to follow up on what Marjorie said a minute ago. How do you feel about this celebrated Pope, who Marjorie and I both admire? According at least to Brother Thomas from this Immaculate Heart of Mary School, he is essentially celebrating acts of grave depravity if he is endorsing civil unions or potentially endorsing civil unions for gays, isn't he?
That is above my pay grade.
Craig, you're an honest man. That's a great call. Thank you, Craig. We appreciate your time.
You know, we're getting this, too, on the emails, people saying, well, Mass Equality could have marched if they didn't mention anywhere that they were gay, that it was a gay group. They didn't do the LGBT kind of thing. But that's sort of the issue here, that the parade organizers want the gay groups to be closeted, and gay groups are tired in 2014 of being closeted. They want to not have to hide what they are. So the organizers say, hide it, you can march. They don't want to hide it anymore. I think that's a big issue. And the other thing is, again, they absolutely, as the last caller just said, have the right to exclude anybody they want. The question is, should they? And if they continue to exclude them, should we be celebrating this parade? I guess that's sort of the issue. Lots of people show up at this parade. Bars up and down East Broadway and West Broadway are open, and everybody runs in there, and people are selling T-shirts and so forth and so on. There's a celebratory atmosphere there, and I'm thinking people should just stay home, or we should get rid of the parade altogether.
By the way, the CNN story by Daniel Burke that came out this morning, there's an interview that the Pope gave to an Italian daily, the name of which I cannot pronounce, saying that longstanding Catholic teaching is marriage is between a man and a woman. However, he said, quote, we have to look at different cases, evaluate them in their variety. For instance, civil unions provide financial security to habitating couples, as for instance in medical care, the Pope said in this. So again, juxtapose that to Wacko Hurley and Brother Thomas Brother Thomas Dalton from this school that will boycott if gays are allowed to be treated equally in this parade.
Jane in Natick, thanks for calling, Jane.
Hi,
Jane.
Why juxtapose Wacko Hurley with Wacko Hurley's opinion with the Pope's opinion? This is a parade. It's a private parade. Yes, the media is making too much of a big deal about this. It doesn't represent Boston. It doesn't represent Irish people. It's a private parade where things happen. It is just not important. It's going to go away eventually.
Jane, if it turns, I don't know this for a fact, but I would surmise that if gays are banned from the parade and St. Patrick's Day comes and goes, the national story, well beyond our borders, is of gays being barred from marching in a private, permitted parade. And I'm sure the story will responsibly say the Supreme Court says it's okay, but this is in the same neighborhood where decades ago other people were not treated terribly well
either. Well, that's the issue. Jane, how would you feel about the parade if they said no one African-American can march?
There's a lot of things that go on in South Boston that I don't like. But it doesn't represent Boston. And the more the media says it represents Boston, the more people outside of Boston will believe that.
By the way, we're not saying it represents Boston. It represents an ancient, discriminatory part of Boston. It surely does. Marty Walsh said to us the other day when he was here, Jane, a week ago Friday, I said, if we did a poll in South Boston of people who live there, what percentage do you think would be for inclusion of the gay organization marching? He said 90%. So it's not even, in his estimation at least, and he's the mayor, you'd think he'd know, it's a small group of people that at least we think are creating a bad image, fairly or unfairly, for the city. Jane, though, thank you for your point of view. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970 is our number.
Mark emails and says, what rocks do these people live under? The permeating culture of ignorance is one of the reasons people leave Greater Boston for work and won't consider coming back. I mean, we do have this reputation for not being very welcome to African-Americans in Boston. And I think this sends out the notion that we're not very welcome to gay people, even though we're the hub of where gay marriage was decided 10 years ago.
Let's go to Candace. You're in Arlington. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call, Candace.
Well, thank you for having me on. I just wanted to say a good compromise would be to sort of ease into it by having two groups of priests, one group representing heterosexual priests and the other representing homosexual priests. And that way everybody would be happy. We'd be focused on the Catholic Irish respect and leave everything else between the priests.
Candace, if we can get you Wacko Hurley's cell phone, could you call him and propose that directly? I want you to know, Marjorie, who's the Catholic in the studio, is laughing quite hard at your suggestion, so I'm not alone. Candace, that's brilliant. Thank you for the call.
Well, in the great Frontline documentary, they had a very poignant moment with gay priest, a celibate gay priest, by the way, who was devastated by the previous Pope Benedict's and John Paul II's attitude about gay priests, that they were, you know, disturbed and disordered and all these kinds of things. And here this guy has devoted his whole life to the Catholic Church in celibacy. Pretty hard for him to hear all that. Let's go to Judy in Arlington. Hi, Judy.
Hi. It's hard to follow up from that last call, though.
Candace,
But I will tell you that I had a similar idea, which was, well, not a similar idea, but a similar reaction. First of all, the hypocrisy of the Catholic Church by sweeping under the rug the whole sexual abuse scandal, the deafening silence. And then they come out so loud and...
Well, I don't think, in fairness, the Catholic Church has weighed in. This one priest has, but I don't think O'Malley has issued any edicts on the St. Patrick's Day parade or anything. I mean, I think this is this one priest from this one school who sounds like he's pretty off out in the weeds somewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but the story that should be the lead story of the day, and we didn't know about it until we were on the air, is Pope Francis saying
exactly.
The church could support civil unions for gays. I mean, it is maybe a half a loaf, but it's a half a loaf that I think most of us thought was not coming anytime in the near future. Judy, thank you so much for for your call.
Okay, we have to move on. Maybe we get back to this between now and the parade. Up next, we're going to be joined by the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGroy. We're going to talk to him about new developments at the Globe. We'll ask him about the media coverage of the St. Patrick's Day parade as well. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
About the best thing you heard on public radio this year. Maybe you heard a report.
She's been the general manager of the MBTA, Beverly.
Who was
Stubb.
Interviewing someone?
It's a pleasure, absolutely.
There was probably also a producer in the next room calling the shots.
We've got our next guest on the line,
and an engineer running the board.
Can I get a mic check, please?
Sounds then good. There's a whole staff of people doing research, taking care of the details, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, and the folks up at Great Blue Hill making sure the antenna works. And last, but certainly not least, there's a community of listeners all across New England.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
And beyond.
Hello.
In other words, no one does public radio alone. And in that spirit, right now, other WGBH supporters are agreeing to match your gift in any amount, dollar for dollar, but only for a limited time. So please call 888-897-9424. The match also works when you give online at wgbhnews.org.
Hear that, Jim? You cannot do it alone. Just want to be clear about that. Because there is a big team, and you want to support us at 888-897-9424 or pitch in online at wgbhnews.org. You are listening to WGBH at a crucial time, our March community campaign, and we are heading toward the finish line. Joining us in studio is Andy Hicks. Hi, Andy.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey. How you doing? Hey, Jim. Hey, Jim, you know who's coming in the studio later?
Like, I don't know who's coming in studio.
Steve Collins.
I've been vibrating all day long.
It's pretty cool. It's a great day for public radio. And not only were we just talking about this this really kind of interesting dynamic where we had with the Irish Parade, St. Patrick's Day Parade in South Boston with what the Pope was saying.
I know.
It's the two different sides of this going on. Plus, you got a folk icon. This is the most public radio day ever, I think. It's just amazing. And not only that, it's a great time to support public radio because right now your gift is going to be matched dollar for dollar by an anonymous member of the Ralph Lowell Society. By the way, the Ralph Lowell Society is WGBH's major donor group named after the founder of WGBH, Ralph Lowell. This is the last match of the entire campaign. Your last chance to have your gift match, your only chance to have your gift match during Jim and Marjorie. You make that $50 contribution, it'll be worth $100. $100 becomes $200. And $150 contribution, which we'll talk about in just a second, becomes $300 worth of support. So please make the call, 888-897-9424, or have your gift matched for the very, very, very last time online at WGBHnews.org.
Very good math there, Andy Hicks. So you can support great music with a gift of, as Andy intimated, $150 right now, and we'll show our thanks with a pair of tickets to see the great Judy Collins. This is the first chance to let WGBH say thanks with these great tickets, and the show will clearly sell out. I am going. I am paying for my tickets, I should say. It's happening Sunday, September 21st at the Great Wilbur Theater in Boston. You've got a call for this one, actually, though. It's 888-897-9424. $150 tickets to see Judy Collins in September. That's again 888-897-9424. And by the way, before we continue, we want to thank Jana from Grafton so we can get in the thank you mode, who just gave online and said she listens to WGBH all day, every day.
Yeah, saying thank you. This is what this March community campaign is really all about. We're on a mission to say thanks to as many people as we can over the next few days. If you value this type of public broadcasting, I hope you'll do your part to support it right now, because we sure would love a chance to say proper thanks to you before this campaign wraps up.
Absolutely. You know, 888-897-9424. That's 888-897-WGBH to pick up those Judy Collins tickets. Very good, very good tickets for that show at the Wilbur Theater Sunday, September 21st. Again, you have to call for those. Your gift will go twice as far right now. You know, you could do it if you've been listening to WGBH for a while, if you watch WGBH programs, if you have for a while. You know, you're probably like me, and I have great parents. I got to say this in front of you guys and in front of the entire world. My parents are fantastic people, and they raised me on public broadcasting. I remember actually watching a Judy Collins special with my dad when I was 11 or 12. And she's playing City of New Orleans, and it's probably one of the first times I ever heard that song. And it was the first time I realized that different people's versions of different songs, they had different takes on it, where Judy does a certain thing at the end of the chorus that Steve Goodman didn't do and just everything. And that's public broadcasting, having that experience, like bonding with my dad over music. And whatever your public broadcasting experience is, keep that kind of stuff happening for people across New England and across the world. Make that gift right now. 888-897-9424. Again, your gift's going to go twice as far right now. We'd like to hear from 60 people, that is you and 59 others, before 2 p.m. I think we can do it. 888-897-9424.
I just want to echo one thing that Andy just said. One of my parents was terrific, too. I really, no, really. One,
my mom was
absolutely
also great,
fabulous. No, but I'm serious. By the way, countdown to Judy Collins in studio, about 30-some minutes. You know, we're all guilty of putting things off, but in this case, we really hope you'll consider doing your part right now, because we're already heading towards the finish line of this campaign. Please don't miss out on today's terrific special offers. All you have to do is, and you should do it now so you don't get distracted and forget, 888-897-9424, or do your good deed online at WGBHnews.org.
I'm Susan Stamberg. In the early days of public broadcasting, the federal government provided the lion's share of funding for programs like Morning Edition, All Things Considered, PBS shows like Sesame Street. Well, times have changed. These days, the majority of money comes from individuals, foundations, and corporations who are passionate about the mission of stations like WGBH. Your support keeps Boston Public Radio available to the whole community. So please, call the station or make your contribution online at WGBHnews.org. And thank you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us online as he does every Wednesday. He's essentially the opening act for Judy Collins, I guess you could say. Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Hi, Brian. You know, before we get you, you've got a lot of big changes going on at the Globe, which I want to talk to you about in a second. But I'm just wondering, you have to think every day about what you're going to put in the front page. We were just talking about the St. Patrick's Day Parade, whether we in the media, we've been all over it in the Herald. You guys have done great stuff in the Globe. Are we paying too much attention to this? What do you think?
I don't think so. There's a confluence of events here, and one is that kind of these kinds of rights are a discussion point all around the country. States are acting on it everywhere. The St. Patrick's Day Parade has been one of the last real holdouts here in Massachusetts. We've been at the vanguard of gay rights here, and I just think it's an interesting story. The parade itself is a touchstone for many, many people. And I think we've been playing it just about right. Did you happen to catch Kevin Cullen's column the other
yes.
day?
We just read from it
yes.
a couple of minutes ago, but say whatever you want. We quoted his quoting of Father, I think his name is Thomas Dalton, who is the head of the school, and his explanation of what really happens at the St. Patrick's Day Parade. Is that true?
It's. Can I be honest with you?
Yeah.
I've never been.
No.
I've never been.
Really?
I've never been. I've... no, but Kevin certainly has. I think he's an annual adherent to it. So, but his column was terrific, talking about of all the people to discriminate for all the people to hold others up as a stereotype. The kind of Irish of South Boston should not be doing this.
Yeah, that was it was a very good point.
Okay,
let's
so
move on.
We read your memo. You didn't send it to us, but we read it at jimromanesco.com that you sent out to all the Globies. Big changes of the Globe. Explain a couple things to us, and the ones that matter most directly to the readers. The paywall is down. What does that mean in English, Brian McGrory?
So, Jim, what you're really trying to ask is, will this allow more people to read your column when you write for the Sunday Globe magazine?
Monthly.
Really,
I write monthly.
Right the
yeah,
well,
you could speak to that. If it wasn't in the memo. I read the memo like four times.
Yeah, he was looking for his name. He was
you're
devastated.
Boldface.
Devastated.
I was putting everyone's name in bold. You know, I had you in about five different times. I ended up having to take it out for space because the memo was only 1,300
right.
words long, so I was running out.
So what's the paywall deal, Brian?
Give me a little bit of love. Was that the single longest memo you've ever read?
It was.
But when a memo has chapters, you know you should probably be a little more brief. But,
well, a lot's going on, Brian.
There is a lot going on. So I'm sorry. What was I
the paywall.
What's
paywall.
With the paywall? What does that mean for readers?
It means great things. I mean, look, we put a paywall up on – we opened up our premium site, bostonglobe.com, 2.5 years ago, and it's been really successful. We've got close to 60,000 digital-only subscribers who pay us close to a couple hundred dollars a year to get full access to Globe stories, Globe photography, Globe videos, Globe graphics, and it's really gratifying. But we believe that if we take that wall down and replace it with a meter, we are essentially betting on ourselves, and we're betting that if people are allowed to read more of our stories, see more of our photography, then they will want full access. So what we're doing is we're giving everybody 10 free clicks a month over a 30-day period. And so we welcome you to the site. You can click on 10 different pieces of content, much as I dislike that description, but 10 stories, 10 whatever. And we're hoping that you'll like what you see and you will subscribe so that you'll get the full range of what we do.
Okay, so let me read from this rather long memo as you described. Second, the paywall is now, this is Brian McGrory writing, it's now officially down at bostonglobe.com. I'm sure there's a Reagan joke to crack here, but it's too obvious even to me. I don't think it was, I think you should have done it. Okay, fine. Second thing that Marjorie and I don't get, and we mean this sincerely, you're in the memo, it's clear, we've all known that this was coming, that this separation between BostonGlobe.com and Boston.com, which is, I think, one of the most visited websites in the country, Boston.com, is nearing completion or whatever. Why? What's the rationale behind the separation of the two sites, Brian?
Well, that's the problem. Nobody gets it. And it's, look, at it, it was destined to be too confusing. It is too confusing. And our goal is to end that confusion. When we opened, Boston.com was our original site for Globe content. We opened it up in 1995, and it's where we put all the content of the Boston Globe on Boston.com. Whoever figured out that they should get site name, what's that thing called when you name a site?
URL?
Don't ask me.
Look at you, Jim. It's like you're working Kendall Square. whoever got the URL, Boston.com, was brilliant. And for many, many years, Boston.com was the Boston Globe's newspaper website. But like many other papers, a couple of years ago, we realized we have to charge for what we do. Good journalism is expensive, and we couldn't give it away for free anymore. So we opened up BostonGlobe.com in addition to Boston.com. Boston.com, as Marjorie pointed out, is one of the most successful newspaper websites in America. But we made this understandable mistake that we still gave away too much Globe material on Boston.com, even as we asked people to pay for it on Globe.com, because we didn't want to ruin Boston.com. So now what we're doing is we're putting all Globe material, everything we do. You know, if Pete Abraham, our great Red Sox reporter, does a blog, that's now going to go on Globe, BostonGlobe.com, now Boston.com. Our dining blog, our health blogs, those are going to go on BostonGlobe.com. And we are going to make Boston.com a completely independent, separate site with its own voices, its own stories, its own graphics. And it's going to reflect with a sharper tone, a more Boston sensibility from the ground up, but more of a community-based site, if that makes sense. And you're about to tell me it doesn't.
No, well, I get it now.
But the thing I don't get, Brian McGroy, I would assume, well, if the Globe has some big spotlight series or something that you have devoted weeks and weeks of reporters' time to.
Well, like your Beta Boston thing,
yeah,
we're going to talk about
Boston
in a minute,
thing.
This privacy versus security issue today.
That, the Boston.com people are not going to be able to go out and duplicate that in 2 days. I mean, you're talking about them competing with you. I don't get how they can compete with you.
Well, why? They're going to compete with us at a different level. I mean, they're not going to have their own spotlight team. But I mean, we have this guy, Dave Epstein, the Boston.com weather blogger.
Yes.
Who may be the most popular blogger in the universe right now. I mean, he gets millions of hits. He's a good, methodical, not hyperbolic weatherman, and people love him. He's on Boston.com. We at Globe.com, BostonGlobe.com, are going to have a tough time competing with him. We don't expect Boston.com to compete with us on things like a spotlight report.
Okay, I got you.
That's not part of the game there.
And by the way, we want to do one shout-out to a woman who was a colleague of ours for about a minute and a half here at WGBH, who is now the news editor at Boston.com, which means it's in good hands. Hillary Sargent, who we worked with for a while.
Very clever.
Is really terrific,
yeah.
And that was a great...
She started here a couple of months ago. She's got a great voice and a terrific eye, and the people over at Boston.com, you know, with my hearty endorsement, have made her the news editor, and she will do terrific. She's just what that site needs.
Now, Brian, I tell you every week, because I've gotten virtually no recognition for this, I am in charge of the McGroy Archives, as you know.
This is my least favorite.
No, it's not. I meant to give you an update, but I've been trying to offer them to a lot of local libraries. The only people who've so far agreed to take them, it's the wine cellar at the Capitol Grill in Burlington. But beyond that, here's what I picked up today. You may recall this. This is written by you, and actually not so long ago, not even a year and a half ago. Day 4, I carried a flashlight everywhere, even in daylight. Don't ask me why. I spent an abnormal amount of time thinking about Thomas Edison, calculated how many more linemen NSTAR could afford if they cut Tom May's pay package by $5 million a year. And admittedly fragile, I openly wept over a melted quart of Brigham's chocolate chip as we tossed the contents of the refrigerator into the trash. So when we had our second storm of the century, you apparently suffered yourself as well. When you wrote a whole series of stories on Tom May, you may recall, who was head of a monopoly, a public utility, no competition, no nothing. The Globe mentioned the other day that he made $7.7 million last year, which is a little lower than he was making when you were writing. What was your reaction to that?
Well, it was a little lower because of some accounting changes. I don't think he actually took a pay cut. It was the way that some of the benefits that he was getting were accounted for. What do you mean, what was my reaction?
I mean, when you picked up the paper that morning, or when you read it before it went to print, what was your reaction? Did you think back to the days when you had written your series on Tom May? What was your personal reaction to that?
You're goading me.
I am. A little bit. What was your reaction?
Every week I take the bait. I'm not going to take it this week. How's that, Jim? Look, I wrote a bunch of. Here I am taking it. I wrote. Yeah. What is it? You're like you're the older brother I never had.
Yeah, exactly.
I wrote several columns that I thought were pretty decent columns. And feel free to interject your own adjective there.
They were pretty decent.
They were very good comms, Brian. But here's what I always wonder. You know, everybody's hysterical about the South Boston parade and a couple of issues we get all worked up about. But people don't seem to get worked up about a guy that's in a public utility that is basically
with no
monopoly.
Competition, right?
Exactly. I don't understand why, because you have to pay your electric bill every month, and you could be like you without your power for days and days and days. This doesn't seem to rev people's jets, and I just don't get it.
Well, you will recall it did get me worked up.
It gets me worked up too.
On him and a friend of his who ran an insurance company.
That is
and
correct.
I put a proposal into print that. Every storm in which there were more than, say, 10,000 people who lost their power, we should just go over to the head of the utilities company and just cut his wires.
And the home of the governor, you wrote.
And the home of the governor.
Right.
And when everybody else is restored, they can be restored, too. I have a feeling we would have all gotten our power back a lot quicker if that was the case.
Yeah, aren't you amazed how much you know about municipal light companies now? Like, after doing all this minutiae, I love it, too. I can't stand the fact these guys make all this money and nobody gets worked up.
Brian, I couldn't read my writing. Can we go back to the new Globe stuff just for a second?
I was hoping you would do that, and I'm hoping you'll concentrate on one thing.
There are two quick things. Is it true, someone just told us in the newsroom this morning, that there's literally going to be a snowbird print edition of the Globe in southern Florida for, I guess, the Boston area exiles? Is that true?
All right, that's not what I was hoping you concentrate
no,
on.
No, I'm going to get to that. Is that true?
That's good, too. It's not that there's going to be. There is. We began printing the Boston Globe down in Fort Myers and actually selling it, and people are distributing it, delivering it to people's homes, snowbirds who are living down there. I mean, half of Weymouth is on Marco Island, for God's sakes. And we've got home delivery of the Globe. We are selling it in every Circle K and whatever else it is they have down there where you get your super big gulp. And it's actually doing quite well.
Well, tell us about another thing that's part of your new stuff going on over there at the Globe, this Beta Boston thing.
Oh, thank you, Marjorie.
Front page story today about this guy from a repossession company running around parking lots and taking pictures of license plates and sends it back to a company that can tell these people, that can tell the repossessor guy if they've have defaulted on their loans and he can take the car. I mean, this raises a huge privacy issue. Tell people about this.
Well, the story, I love this story. It's incredible. These cars or trucks with scanners in them will just drive down the street or through parking lots, as Marjorie said, and these scanners will just drink in all these license plate numbers and beam them somewhere else where you can find out if the car is something that should be repossessed or if it was stolen. And the scanner guys will get a bit of a bounty off every car they discover that people are looking for. But it also can be used by insurance companies who buy these massive lists of tens and tens of millions of license plates to see if somebody was lying about where they're garaging or parking their car. It can be used for all sorts of potentially nefarious purposes. And it makes the NSA look like, Mr. Magoo, for God's sakes. So there's a hearing up in the State House today to figure out whether these things should be illegal here in Massachusetts. They're not right now. But if I can just step back on that for a moment, this was published in the Globe, but it's part of our new Beta Boston project, which was also part of that memo yesterday. Beta Boston is a new website that the Globe has launched as of Monday that is covering the innovation economy here in Boston and Cambridge and the whole region. And it's betaboston.com. We have hired several of the brightest, best reporters in high tech in this area. We have paired them with a terrific editor, Mike Morrissey, and we are going to flood the zone on coverage of increasingly important tech, high tech, and biotech issues here in the region.
While you were just saying that, I did check. It is the longest memo ever written by an editor of a major newspaper.
Isn't that great? Isn't that great, Marjorie? Here
I spoke to the Guinness people.
Yeah, I am pouring my soul out on our new initiatives. Jim is there yawning, drinking coffee.
I'm not yawning. I am drinking coffee. I was actually reading your column about Tom May.
He did. Too. He read whole paragraphs up in the newsroom before we get down here. He loves your Tom May stories, Brian.
Oh, man. Well, so does he. I mean, notice, by the way, that Brian says, don't put me in this position. So what does he do? He slides in his series on Ted Kelly at Liberty Mutual, hoping that I would take the bait and start talking about it, which I didn't. So fine. You know, Brian, this is really an all-Globe segment today, not just your view of the world. Mike Resendez wrote a great front page Sunday story a couple of weeks ago about a tragic situation that got action. The story of the death of a guy at Bridgewater State in 2009. Well, why don't you tell the brief version of the story, and then we want to ask you about the essentially what the bottom line was here.
Well, the very brief version is that this young man was sent down to Bridgewater State Hospital. He was schizophrenic, and he was having an attack down there. And it seems like after the attack was over, and he had, you know, the tendency to get violent, as people with this affliction do. But after he had gotten over the attack, the guards grabbed him, ushered him into some sort of special room, and did this awful method of what's described as suitcasing him, where they pin him on the ground and sit on his back after it already appeared he was calm. And this was all videotaped, and while these guards were on his back, he apparently died of what seemed to be a heart attack. The medical examiner down there ruled it a homicide, meaning that the guards had some role in his death. And that was back in, what,
2009?
And then nothing happened, absolutely nothing. The guards were never charged. They were never civilly punished. There were no repercussions at work. They are still guards, most of them. And it just lingered there until we picked up on it, Mike Resendez, with a fantastic story a couple of weeks ago, in which he detailed what went on. So this past weekend, Governor Patrick decided that action needed to be taken, and he disciplined, meaning suspended, or took some other sanction against half a dozen people within the department, including, you know, suspensions and official reprimands. And we will have more to say on it as well. We are continuing to investigate it, and there is more to say.
Well, you know, it's great that Governor Patrick took this action last weekend, but obviously it's really disturbing that the medical examiner declares this a homicide, and it takes all this time and Resendez stories before apparently the governor even knew about this.
That, I mean, Marjorie, you know as well as I do, that's why you and your paper exist. That's why the Globe exists. This is this is journalism at its best, when we can hold people accountable. And unfortunately, you know, for whatever reason, in the state, that seems to be very much required on a regular basis.
What do you make? I mean, we've asked you this before, and I know you can't really opine, Brian, but there have been a whole series of developments that have been troubling in terms of Deval Patrick's reaction. Your columnist, Scott Lehigh, called him Mr. Magoo and seemed to be unable to see any of these things.
Well, Joan Vernocchi was excoriated
the
day
before, too. That's right.
Too, yeah.
I mean, look, there's I'm going to be careful here, but there's no question that there seems to be you know, some loose threads here as he is in the final year of his second term, and others have said it far better than I ever would or would want to, and you know, I'll just leave it at that.
You know, Brian, I don't know if you can do this on Boston. I don't know what's what these days, even though you explained it well.
Come on, wait a minute. Wait,
no,
you
explained it well.
Understood the explanation.
No, I do understand. But just a quick question. I guess I should text
memo.
You. I'm going to be reading from your Tom May columns tonight at Grill 23. Is there any way there could at least be a mention of that? Can you talk to somebody or no?
I will.
You will, okay.
Jim is really upset that he was not mentioned in an internal.
Well, there's going to be another memo, isn't there?
He also would like bigger type for his name on the front page of the magazine when he has his pieces in there. He's really distressed. It's
counting on you, Brian.
Quite large enough for
him. Hey, Brian McGrory, it's good to talk to you. Thanks so much, and good luck with all the changes. They look great.
Guys, thank you very much.
Thank you. Brian McGrory is editor of the Boston Globe. He joins us every Wednesday. Up next, medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us to go over the e-cigarette paradox and the false hope of FDA nutrition labels. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've already been to Paris, already been to Rome. And what did I do but miss my home? Oh, acapella now.
Hi, I'm Emily Rooney, host for WGBH Radio and Television. My job is to help keep you informed on what's happening here in New England. We've got you covered, from the political buzz about town to arts, music, and best of all, the people who have personal stories to share. So at this very moment in New England, what you need to know is that other WGBH supporters are offering to match your gift, dollar for dollar. Here are a couple of people who know a lot more about it to tell you how it works.
Okay, I got to read thank yous right away, because if I don't, Marjorie's going to steal the piece of paper with the thank yous on, so I'm going to do it before she does. Thanks to Sylvia in Newton. Thanks to Paulette in Scituate, who said, by the way, Marjorie, I've listened to Jim and Marjorie for as long as I can remember, and I am so happy that they are on your station. By the way, Paulette, so are we. Jennifer in Providence, Bill in Wellesley Hills, Sarah in Lincoln, and Sandra in Mashpee. Again, whatever you can contribute, like these fine souls right now, will go twice as far. Andy will explain that in a minute. The number is 888-897-9424. Or you can do this all online at WGBHnews.org. Good afternoon. I am Jim Browdy. Marjorie is here, as is our colleague, Andy Hicks. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Jim. How you doing? The number to call, 888-897-9424. Or you can pitch in online at WGBHnews.org. We started out needing to hear from 60 people to stay on track during this dollar-for-dollar match today. We're looking to hear from 48 right now. We're down. We're getting there. I think we can do it. 47 people and you pitching in to help support Jim and Marjorie and having your gift go twice as far for the last time during this drive. And, you know, it's starting to snow a little bit outside. You're not going anywhere. Come on, just pick up the phone, make that call. The match sponsored, by the way, by, as Jim said, by a generous member of the Ralph Lowell Society who is asked to remain anonymous, and that is the WGBH's major donor group named after the founder of WGBH, Ralph Lowell. He's a guy who back in 1951 looked around at New England and thought, you know what this place needs? Public broadcasting. It needs a place where the arts and culture and news and you know, education has a place on the air. That's why we're here, and that's why you're here. 888-897-9424, or you can have your gift matched for the very last time online at WGBHnews.org. Somebody just came in. Marjorie, there's a name that you've
got. Yes, there is. Rick Schwartz from Longwood MRI. He just donated, and we wanted to – he's a good friend of ours.
I remember Rick from our former lives.
Yes, and he does great MRIs down there, actually. Did a nice MRI with my kick of the concussion, so he was wonderful. And speaking of kids
– thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Rick. Every single kid does deserve a chance, and you probably know this, but in case you don't, as a WGBH supporter, you should know you are helping WGBH provide more than 34,000 free classroom resources, from workbooks to apps and beyond, that are used in more than 75% of American classrooms, which is pretty neat. Plus, you're also keeping the programs you love available to everyone here on the radio. That is huge impact.
And listeners in all six New England states, I don't know if you knew this, can access 89.7, which means in about 25 minutes you can hear our conversation with Judy Collins in studio. Television viewers across the region have access to WGBH2, WGBX44, and on cable, WGBH World and WGBH Kids. So if you can swing a gift, and we know not everybody can, of $500 or $1,000 right now, you'll be helping in a really, really big way, in the kind of way that reaches more New Englanders than any other public broadcaster in the region. And I want to remind you, as Andy has today, it'll go twice as far thanks to this spectacular dollar for dollar match.
Yeah, you know, if you think about the kind of things that you might contribute to over the course of the year, any kind of charity, any kind of, you know, public resource. Well, this is a pretty good public resource right here. This is where kids are learning how to read, and you're getting the latest news information, local, national, and international, every single day. I mean, it's just, it's fantastic, and it's all because of you. You make that $150 contribution right now, and again, we'll say thanks with a pair of Judy Collins tickets. She is coming up on the show, and she's coming to town in September. But we should mention this. The mission of our March community campaign at the end of the day is to say thanks to as many people as we can. We'd love to say thanks to you next. 888-897-9424. Or your gift will again go twice as far either way when you give online as well at WGBHnews.org.
So please help out however you can today and take advantage of the special offers on the table. And remember, we are on a thank you mission. We want to say thanks to you. Thanks again, Rick Schwartz. So I hope you'll do your part right now. 888-897-9424 or get involved online at WGBHnews.org.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition from NPR News. You know, there's an old New Yorker cartoon. It shows two people standing at a party. They're talking, and the man says to the woman, "It's not just my opinion. It's the opinion of somebody I heard on NPR." You hear something, and during a conversation, the subject comes up again, and you realize you know what's going on. You can talk about it. You understand the story. It's a pretty common refrain among people because this is where you come to get information in context. You rely on public radio, and we rely on you. Without your contributions, public radio reporters cannot afford to tell the stories that you want to hear. And that's the way it should be. You support public radio, you get the value. Your community does too.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. This is Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Now that smoking has gone electric by way of the e-cigarette, it's become a lifeline for people trying to kick the habit, including House of Cards VP Frances Underwood and the real-life smoker-in-chief President Obama, who is rumored to own one. But could it also be the gateway device to nicotine and tobacco products for teens who are enchanted by the e-cig? Joining us on the line to talk about the e-cigarette paradox, among other health headlines, is Art Kaplan. Art's the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art, happy 2014. Great to have you back.
Thank you for having me back, Jim.
Hi, Art. Thank you for being with us. So what do you think, Art? Is this going to cause more of a problem with nicotine addiction or not?
Well, you know, the experts are fighting. There is a sort of a cabal that says this is really useful for helping people to quit smoking, although I have to say I'm not sure whether the data is in on that one yet. It is being tried by smokers as a route to quit, but whether it works, I don't think we actually know. And remember, some of the fighting that goes on is because there's a vested interest that doesn't like e-cigarettes as a way to quit smoking. That's the patch people. There's a battle out there. They've been pushing, you know, nicotine patches and chewing gum and that sort of thing, and the companies that make that stuff are not thrilled to see all of a sudden these e-cigarettes appear saying, hey, we can help you quit too. So part of the confusion is vested interest. There is a big industry in the I'm going to help you stop smoking side. At the other end, I think all the tobacco experts are freaking out that e-cigarettes are being marketed to kids, that it's a backdoor way to get a form of smoking there. And I have to say, with cities like San Francisco and Chicago, New York, starting to restrict e-smoking, the data seems to be there that that is a gateway drug for kids to get into smoking. There's still nicotine delivery devices.
But while the issue is unresolved for the most part, even though, as Marjorie, I'm sure, is going to say in a minute, I have an obsession.
He does.
And it's not a pro-obsession with e-cigarettes. Let's assume you're summoned to
I have to ask, what is your obsession?
I am so anti-cigarette smoking.
Oh, he has no
that it's an illness
whatsoever for the addiction of cigarettes, Art. It's really disgraceful.
What are we going to say,
Art? Got it.
Well, in any case, but...
So, yes, I'm looking forward to your now clearly bigoted perspective, but go on. Yes.
No, this is actually going to be open-minded for a change on my part. So Art Kaplan is requested to testify in front of a public health commission at a major city that is contemplating adding itself to the list of cities that don't just ban cigarette smoking, but ban e-cigarette smoking. What do you say to them? What's your recommendation?
I would say ban them.
Why?
I would say they're being used too much by young kids. The marketing is targeting young kids. If you want to make them tools for getting off cigarettes, you might even say, hey, let's get them approved by the FDA for that purpose. Let's maybe even have them available with a doctor's recommendation. But I'm more worried about the damage potential than I am the quitting possibilities. Or to put it another way, it's tough to quit. It's easy to get addicted, and I'm sorry, Marjorie, to feed his obsession.
Well, it is hard to quit, and I'm glad you brought that up. Did you ever smoke when you were younger, Art?
Oh, a long, long time ago. High school for a little bit and then stopped.
Okay, well, I used to smoke, too, and I thought one of the hardest things about quitting, because I never smoked enough to be addicted, to nicotine. It was the habit of having something in my hand when I was drinking a cup of coffee or when I was going to a bar or whatever. And that's, to me, is what's so dangerous about e-cigarettes is because the habit of that hand thing continues.
Yeah, I think there's sort of putting something in your mouth. You got the whole ritual.
Exactly.
And there's certain times when you smoke, and I don't just mean after sex. I mean, you know, the morning coffee thing and the whole thing. So that is part of what is addictive. I'm sure the rituals and the behaviors are part of that. And e-cigarettes for kids, sadly, kind of reinforce that because you do it in a group and you do it to be cool, all the reasons that other people in previous generations started smoking cigarettes. So other things being equal, from a justice point of view, if I'm not sure whether it helps you quit, and I do think it might lead you to smoke or at least smoke things that give you nicotine addiction, I'm going to err on the side of saying let's restrict.
Okay, Art Kaplan, you've weighed in on that one. Let's move on to something else. The Food and Drug Administration is proposing these major changes in nutrition labelings. It's significant because it's bigger than anything they've done in two decades. So what are they doing, and what is the significance?
And before you answer, Art, I should warn you, this is another obsession.
Jim is obsessed.
This is just coincidence. I'm sorry.
This is like the OCD segment.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Art. I'm sorry.
All right. So I'm going to maybe irritate everybody with my response on this. What they're trying to do is to make the labels clearer, get off the front of the box where all those claims are, you know, that it's made from pure and wholesome things and it's a great source of protein or a wonderful source of iron, all of which is advertising. There's no definition of what's a wonderful source of X. Get on the label, the little thing on the back, and read it and be able to understand it. And that will help people, you know, make better dietary choices. You look at the sugar content, you look at the fat content, it'll be there in easier to understand form than it is now. My response to that is, you're kidding me. I mean, people do not guide their food choices by what's on those little labels. Or should I say, there's a tiny subset of people, of which Jim may be the leader, who do. But you know, food advertising, food marketing, that's what makes people buy foods, not this kind of nutritional examination, bringing out your little flashlight in the middle of the aisle and saying, oh, I didn't realize there was a lot of sugar in, you know, that cereal.
Yeah, but Art, since this is going to be your last appearance ever on our show, let me say this as clearly as people, and I am the perfect example of this. People delude themselves into believing what, in my estimation, this is anecdotal, believing what they read on one of these labels. Let me give you an example. While most of the proponents of this, which may or may not ultimately happen after a couple of years, are talking about the extra line that's going to be added, about sugar that's added as opposed to sugar that's intrinsic to the fruit or the whatever. To me, the biggest problem in America in terms of weight control is portion control. I mean, you go to places like, what's that name of that restaurant I mention all the time? It's in the Galleria in Cambridge. Cheesecake Factory.
Oh, Cheesecake.
I mean, they could feed a small nation with a typical lunch. And when you look for, I know one of the changes is they're going to go from unrealistic portions. For example, now the portion size for ice cream is a half a cup. That's like saying people have a thimble full of ice cream. It's unrealistic. If I, when I'm concerned about my weight, see a startling number of calories as opposed to a phony number, it is going to affect my behavior, isn't it? It has in my case.
Oh, you dreamer. You know, when they put up the calories at the fast food places now or other restaurants, you know what the impact is? Nothing.
I've read that, actually. Yeah.
And it's not going to be anything on these labels. I'm not against the label reform. Don't get me wrong. I having information It's not a bad thing. More clear information, that's a good thing. But I think food is so emotional and so weird and so driven, as I said, by marketing and commercials and big advertising and placement. And, you know, you said, you mentioned the Galleria. So there's what, 59 restaurants in there. You'd think that a famine was impending. And when I drive home, I go by, I counted 11 fast food places.
Yeah.
So temptation is everywhere, advertising all over the place. Kids are bombarded with messages about, you know, tasty things to eat. Portion size is out of control. I agree. Corn syrups and everything. Thinking that you're going to solve this by having somebody come in and sort of say, you know, I'll study this. I mean, maybe Jim will, but him and his two friends, aside from them, the rest of us are just going to be there saying, boy, look at that cute leprechaun on the cereal box. That's for me.
Dr. R. Kaplan, you touched on something that I really find fascinating, this whole thing about the portion size exploding. This story says that in the 70s and 80s, the portion size, like, for example, a muffin was much smaller. Mm-hmm. So what's up with that? Are we talking about?
I'll tell you what's up with that. You'll like this, Marjorie, because you'll know it's true. Not only did portion size expand, we started to phony up our clothing sizes. So what used to be small and medium and large, and what used to be a 44 or a 36 waist and all that, it's all expanded. So we're eating bigger portions, and we just decide to lie to ourselves about our clothing sizes. I think what's up with the portion explosion is basically people have a huge incentive to sell you more food.
Yeah.
And it's that basic. And that's the moral norm, sell you more food. And if you take someone from Europe into an American restaurant, Jim hinted at this before, and you show them the size steak you're going to get, or if you take them to one of these old country buffet-type places or smorgasbord-type things that we have, they're going to, like, pass out. They won't believe how much food you are getting at the average meal. So I think that's the answer to our obesity problem. Too much food, heavily advertised.
Okay.
Not people failing to look at the tiny print on the box.
Let's talk about something else that you weighed in on at CNN with some really upsetting perspective, I thought, about this new proposal that the FDA is also considering, this three-parent embryo.
Mm.
Explain to people what that is and why you have some concerns.
So basically, scientists have figured out a solution to a very rare disease called mitochondrial diseases. And mitochondria are just little bits of the cell. They're not in the nucleus. Remember that donut hole from your high school textbook where
Yep.
most of the genes reside? Well, mitochondria float around in the goopy part of the cell, and they're in all our cells, and they're the battery packs. You know, when the cells are dividing and we watch all those pictures of the embryo developing, it takes a little bit of power. Mitochondria are batteries. So they're not really responsible for our traits or our behaviors, but they supply the juice that lets us function. If you have a mistake in those things, you don't get power and you get sick. And often, in fact, there's a lot of stillbirths and miscarriages due to these problems. So you could transplant some mitochondria from a normal egg into a woman who's had a child with a problem, replace her batteries with these new batteries, kind of like an organ transplant or even a battery replacement, and potentially fix the disease. I think that's good. I think that's great. I don't really have a lot of problem with trying that, but we probably don't have enough animal work yet to establish safety. There's some monkeys that have been done, and they appear healthy, but we haven't followed them for very long. I would like to see us do these experiments a little bit more in the lab and in primates, just to make sure that these little battery transplants work. Long term, the freaky part is if you start transplanting these mitochondria, they're inherited. And what that means, Marjorie, is we've crossed the line. We're starting to change our descendants. In other words, these mitochondria are passed on to our grandchildren and their grandchildren and on and on. There's nothing wrong with mitochondria being passed on, but we haven't addressed the question yet, what else would we do to engineer our kids? Great for diseases, but what about that day when the day comes and somebody says, Jim is my ideal guy, I want a baby like that, design traits like him, and that's what I want to engineer into my kids. Will you do that just because I want to improve or enhance, or maybe in Jim's case, destroy, retard, but whatever it is, I want to change my kid. Are we going down that road of to be blunt, eugenics.
Yeah.
But how do you, Art, the concern, Marjorie and I were talking about this morning. You know, it's so hard to argue against the first half of what you're describing, assuming that enough testing is done that the risk is reduced to a mm-hmm. level that people like you and others consider acceptable. But to use an overused expression, the genie's out of the bottle at that point. I mean, how do you control so that this doesn't become a designer kid issue 10 years, 15, 20 yeah. years down the line? How do you stop that?
Well, one way you don't do it, I don't think, is you can't hold these parents and families hostage and say, because we can't control ourselves, you yeah. can't fix your kid. Yeah. That seems to me wrong. At the same time, we could set out a bright line that says, medicine is going to use this to fix diseases, and here's the clear-cut categories, and if you want to try it, you have to get approval, so to speak, that that's a disease worthy of repair. If you're just showing up for freckles or blonde hair or height or musical aptitude, nope, we're not going to be able to do that for you. Do I really think we're going to be able to restrict this? In all honesty, I don't. I think we are going to slide toward designing our descendants. I think it's going to become a huge issue on par with abortion in about 10 years because the genetics is moving fast so that we understand how to tweak things. But I agree. If you really said put your money down on this one, I think we're going to be doing some designing of children down the road.
So, Art Kaplan, it's time for a quiz for you. You ready?
I'm ready.
What do Saul Bellow and Tony Randall sort of have in common?
Had babies when they were old.
Give him the point. Saul Bellow, 84. Tony Randall, 79. The study that came out this week obviously isn't talking about people who are septuagenarians and octogenarians, but talk about the pretty dramatic research that was released about kids born to middle-age fathers and what the implications are.
Yeah, it turns out that we have looked a long time at women and the impact of maternal age on the health of children, both women who just have children, say, over 35, and then some who have children using in vitro fertilization when they're even older. They may not use older eggs, but they wind up obviously being older moms. And that's kind of been sexist because, as you point out, there are plenty of old men who've been chugging along, reproducing very old. I'm thinking of the nightmarish scenario of Larry King, Saul Bellow, and Tony Randall in the same room with their kids and what that might look like. But put that aside, we haven't really studied it. And I think there has been sexism in this. So finally, we get a little bit of a study and we find out older dads, 45 and up, I think is kind of the age here, their kids have more problems. There are some health problems, literally physical problems that are at higher incidences, and there are behavioral problems, including a higher incidence of certain forms of mental illness. What that's all about, I don't think anybody knows. I think the association is there, and we're going to have to figure out what it is that might be responsible for that, but there are some risks with older dads.
You know, I am so glad you mentioned the sexism here because I remember having my first kid at 30, which is not exactly mm-hmm. ancient, and they have a medical term for it. It's a Latin term about older mother, which they call you actually, at least they did when my kid was born at 30. And I thought, God, you know, I'm really not that old. And the emphasis was all on that. And also there's a link between older fathers and this epidemic in autism.
Yes. So we've seen that health issue. There's definitely a connection to some factor. Genetic mutation rates accumulate in moms as you get older. That's the Down syndrome connection. But it appears that it's linked up to both sexes in terms of autism. So one thing that's interesting is you watch these talk shows on TV, or some people watch them, but when I watch them, there are a lot of celebrities coming on saying, yes, I've had my child at 45, or, you know, congratulations to the celebrity dad who had his fourth round of children at 70 or whatever it is. There's no hint of any problems or potential issues that might come up through this. There is this idea that you can have children at any age. Now, I'm not saying the risks are so huge that we should stop it or prohibit it, but you want to be thinking about it. It's part of, I think, responsible parenting. If you're thinking about delaying, well, there are some reasons to do that in terms of health that might weigh in there. And I know there's also perhaps more resource availability if you have more money when you're older. That's a plus side thing. But it's, you know, we have to build that into the equation of what good parenting is.
You know, Art Kaplan, last thing from me is this is clearly important research, but when you read a headline, mental illness risks risk higher for children of older fathers, study finds, that's the New York Times headline, it's pretty scary. And mm-hmm. when you read bipolar disorder, 25-fold, 20-something fathers as opposed to 40-something fathers, attention deficit issues, 13-fold, which is huge. But things like autism, which obviously has created, there's been a huge amount of focus. According to these people, the children of healthy parents in their 20s, the rate's 1 in 300 or even lower. A 3-fold increase would put, according to the New York Times, the odds about 1 in 100, still really, really low.
Right.
And so do
right.
people like you not worry that when a headline like that appears, which is not irresponsible, it is what the study says, that the reaction to it may be far more dramatic than the actual numbers would recommend? You know what I'm trying to say?
I absolutely understand what you're saying, and it's a problem in informed consent in using statistics. Getting a 13-fold increase of something that the risk rate was 1 in 100,000 and moving it up to 13 in 100,000 yeah. is, you know, it's still a rare event. So you need a little counseling. You want to have some conversation. You're thinking about parenting and you want to ask your doc, you know, well, aside from these comparative risks, what's the real risk?
Yeah.
I mean, what are we really talking about here? And I think good media coverage requires accuracy there, which we often don't get. By the way, one other group that offends in this area, all those genomics companies that are pushing you to get a genetic test, they're sort of saying, you know, you could be at a tenfold risk of this bizarro disease. What they don't say is that occurs 1 in a billion, and now it might be 10 in a billion for you.
You know, last thought, I think you'll like this, and I'd like you to ponder it until we talk next time. Maybe we should just label 45-year-old men and up. What do you think, Art?
I
have little labels on.
Yeah. I believe women have done that.
I think we want an equal playing field here, equal blame for the older mothers and older fathers, because heaven knows older mothers have been getting it for years.
Hey, Art Kaplan.
They have. And you're absolutely right about that. I would absolutely say male scientists, kind of more interested in what might be wrong with females than males.
Exactly.
See you at the Cheesecake Factory, Art. Thanks so much for your time.
And I'll know it's you because you'll be reading a label.
Thank you very much, Art Kaplan, for being with us. Art Kaplan is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Thanks, Art.
Thank you.
Okay, coming up next, we're going to be joined by the folk legend Judy Collins. Can't wait. That's up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
When you support Boston Public Radio right now, you can make a real impact in your community. Because right now, other WGBH supporters are matching every gift, in any amount, dollar for dollar. That's twice as much support for real journalism. Twice as much support for NPR News. Twice as much support for everything you hear on Boston Public Radio. It's your chance to make a real difference, but it won't last long. So call 888-897-9424 or take advantage of this dollar-for-dollar match at wgbhnews.org.
It is really easy to do at wgbhnews.org with a quick call to 888-897-9424. Good afternoon. I'm Marjorie Egan. You are listening to WGBH during our March community campaign, and we are getting close to the end of it. And that's great. Here to help me and Jim encourage you to get involved is Andy Hicks. Hi, Andy.
Hey, guys. And
hey,
I want to apologize for not being Judy Collins right now.
It's okay.
She is coming up, I promise. But we've got good news as well. Again, we're getting near the end of this campaign. It'll be over by this time next week. We're wrapping it up this week. In fact, this is the last dollar-for-dollar match of the entire campaign and your last chance to support these two here on 89.7 and have your gift go twice as far. It's sponsored by a generous member of the Ralph Lowell Society who wishes to remain anonymous. And by the way, Ralph Lowell is a guy who back in 1951 founded WGBH, made this whole place possible, and helped to really kickstart public broadcasting here in this area. And honestly, kind of really made a big impact throughout the world. And that's what you're doing right now when you make that gift, when you make that call. 888-897-9424. You're investing in public broadcasting, and you're investing in the kind of place that we can go from, you know, we're talking about local stories and talking about earlier in the show the parade in South Boston. Now we've got Judy Collins coming on. This is the kind of show where that happens. Only on public broadcasting can you hear that kind of variety. Please make that call. Have your gift go twice as far. 888-897-9424 or online at WGBHnews.org.
One quick question, Andy. Who is that anonymous donor, by the way?
It's an anonymous donor.
Thank you very much.
I tell you.
Support, I was hoping I could trap them there. You can support great music, and I do mean great music, with a gift of $150 right now. And we'll show our thanks with a pair of tickets to see Judy Collins.
Woo-hoo.
This is the first chance to let WGBH say thanks for these great tickets, and the show is definitely going to sell out. It's happening Sunday, September 21st at a great theater, too. Great match, great performer, great theater, the Wilbur Theater. You've got a call for this one, meaning it's a phone-only kind of deal, 888-897-9424. Again, that's 888-897-9424.
Okay, we have lots of people to thank, and we are really, really grateful to you guys for helping out here. Maraid in Hopkinton, Anita in Nahant, Marilyn in Milford, Dana in Sharon, Leslie in Lowell. We also heard from Brookline. Thanks to Shauna in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Mildred in Burlington, and Barbara in Marlborough. We have 28 people left to thank before 2 p.m. And thanks again for all your help.
That's right. Thank you so much for your help. If you have done your part, thank you very much. If you haven't, there's still time. Still time to have your gift go twice as far. This is the last time you can do it during Jim and Marjorie's program. The number to call, 888-897-9424. You can always do your part online at WGBHnews.org. I should remind you, however, if you do want to pick up those Judy Collins tickets as our way of saying thanks, you have to make the call. They're only available over the phones because there's a limited number, but these seats are great. They're very, very good seats at like Jim said, a beautiful theater over at the Wilbur. The number to call, 888-897-9424. Make your $150 contribution. It goes twice as far. We say thanks with two tickets. Everybody wins.
Yeah, there's some great incentives, as you've heard, to get involved right now. Among them, keeping me and Marjorie employed, which is probably on the top of our list.
I like that.
But frankly, the real reason to get involved is because you believe in public broadcasting, as we always have, that it helps get you through the day, the commute, that it helps your family, your friends, your neighbors do the same. We're getting close to the end of this March community campaign, so Marjorie and I and Andy really, really hope you'll get involved right now. Take advantage of this dollar-for-dollar match, which is terrific. You call 888-897-9424 or simply go online at WGBHnews.org.
When I was a kid growing up, I was in love with the Zoom program, and I had a dream to become a Zoomer myself. I'm Ray Mancini. I'm from Providence, Rhode Island, and I am a WGBH sustainer. I decided to support WGBH when all of a sudden I realized, you know, it was stunning, actually, what a big part of my life WGBH had become over the years. And although I never realized that dream, you know, watching that show and watching WGBH was such an important part of my life. And today, WGBH Radio is about the only radio I listen to. I mean, I love Morning Edition and Boston Public Radio and The Takeaway, Marketplace, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and the list goes on and on. So I feel like it's not my duty, but my pleasure to support the programming that's so important to me. Oh, 2, 1, 3, 4. You know what? I probably could sing the whole Zoom song if I put my mind to it. There's a young man that I know, his age is 21.
Hi, Marjorie. Thank you so much for coming. Comes from down in southern
Colorado. That is, by the way, one of Marjorie Egan's all-time favorite songs. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Joining us here in Studio 3 is the award-winning, legendary singer-songwriter Judy Collins. Folk legends Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger were inspired by her, and she inspired people like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and me, I should say. If you can't get enough of Judy Collins from your music collection, you can catch her live tonight at 9 p.m. on WGBH Channel 2 for what's called Judy Collins Live in Ireland. Judy, it's really great to meet you. Thanks so much
for
being here.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Fabulous
hat, by the way.
Thank you so
much for coming.
It is a great hat, and I love that little decoration, the little rhinestone deal there on the front. It's gorgeous.
It's a headlight.
Okay, headlight. Assuming that they're not real diamonds.
Oh, yes. You know what Mae West said to her dresser when she went into the dressing room, and her dresser said, "Oh, my goodness, those diamonds." And Mae said, "My goodness has nothing to do with it."
That's a great line. That's a great line. So we'd love to talk about how you tell people how you get started in this business, because you got a great story. But before that, what are you doing exactly, please, tonight at 9 o'clock? What's going to happen?
Oh, we're showing Judy Collins live in Ireland, a concert I recorded in Dromoland Castle in County Clare in September. All the songs that I grew up with, Danny Boy, The Wild Mountain Time, Barbara Allen, The Gypsy Rover, and many others. I have three guests. I have Mary Black, who's a wonderful Irish singer, and Ari Hest, who's a great young American singer-songwriter, and a step dancer who looks a lot like Jean Butler, whose name is Emily Ellis, who is 6 years old, and she's dancing on one of my songs called Granddaddy, which is about one of my... And, you know, people are telling me that they love the new song I wrote for this show called New Moon Over the Hudson. Really, it's about the Irish diaspora, and it was inspired by the fact that I learned a little more from my genealogist about my Irish forefathers who fought in the Civil War and also in the Revolutionary War. We came over very early, 1720, 1730.
Wow.
So it's so exciting for me. And there are also interviews, and there's a kind of running dialogue and beautiful photography and lots of good music. And I'll be here, and I'll be talking about the program and, of course, breaking into a little lilting Irish song once in a while, I think.
Feel free. You know, I just had an out-of-body experience. While you were speaking, and don't take offense, my mind drifted for 1 second, and then all of a sudden I looked and I said, "That's Judy Collins." It was like, all of a sudden, oh, there she is. You know, I've read some of the things about tonight's show, and I can't wait to see it. You do some covers of some great songs. When you do, one of my favorite things you do, Marjorie and I were talking about, you do In My Life. And my attitude my whole life is no one should, who has the courage to do a cover of a great Beatles song, John Lennon's? Are you ever intimidated when you're doing one of the great Lennons or Joni Mitchell's? Does it ever say to you, "Oh my God," no?
Well, you see, first of all, I was raised and trained musically to interpret. I mean, my whole life was about studying piano and studying Rachmaninoff and Bach and Beethoven and studying and singing all the Great American Songbook songs. My dad was in the radio business. He had a radio show for 30 years and sang, was a great singer, great performer. So my feeling about songs is, first of all, we don't own them. They have a life of their own. And when I get struck by a song, it's like being hit by Cupid's arrow, because you don't get over it. You know, it's a physical manifestation of who you are, what you like, what your history is. And so there's never any mistake about this arrow that comes at you with the name of a song on it, and you can't get it out of your mind. So I never have any question about, if it does that, then I'm meant to do it.
You know, you mentioned your father and you mentioned piano. Can we go back to little Judy Collins for a second?
In her little poodle skirt that we read about?
Oh, yes.
So tell us about little Judy Collins and how she became this Judy Collins. Where did it all begin, Judy?
Well, it was in the home of my dad. My dad was really, truly a great entertainer and a great singer. And so I just fell into it naturally. I've recently found out that my grandmother Bird in Seattle, and I didn't know this, she sang and she took singing lessons. There was a piano there. One of my first pictures, little child pictures of me when I was two or something, is standing trying to get my hands on the piano like Daddy did, you know. And I guess like my grandmother did, because she played, she studied singing. Who knew? I didn't know that. Nobody told me that for a long time. And then my dad sang. I loved the songs. I would sing along. Then soon I was studying the piano. It all sort of evolved in a natural way. But it's also the continuation of a family business, in a way.
But, you know, you think of it, most people that spend their childhoods doing Rachmaninoff and Bach and Beethoven and preludes and fugues don't wind up...
Like you, for example.
Right.
Really?
Play the piano, too. But don't go in become a folk singer. And so you had this transition somewhere along the line. Was this when you were 15, 16, 17, 18?
Well, the seeds for this were the fact that my father was part Irish and part English and hated the English and sang songs that I always thought were probably Rodgers and Hart, which were actually Irish ballads and Irish. And he sang Danny Boy, and he sang, you know, I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen, and so on. So I didn't realize it, but that was in there waiting for me to hear for the first time when I was about 14 and a half, The Gypsy Rover and Barbara Allen, which are the songs that I heard on the radio. One was from a film score, Alan Ladd's film about the Gypsy Rover, The Bold Knight, it was called. And one was a version of Barbara Allen sung by Joe Stafford. It wasn't Woody Guthrie. It wasn't Pete Seeger. Yeah. It was like the movies coming into your living room and saying, oh, but I fell in love with the music. And then I joined the Denver Folklore Society, and then it was off with the poodle skirt, you okay. know, and on with the Levi's.
So how did you wind up getting down that whole scene in, you know, the bohemian scene with Bob Dylan, et cetera? I mean,
I just landed there. I mean, it's
big smile on Judy Collins' face when she's responding to this one.
Every moment, every step was like I was landing in a field of wildflowers with all these other singers around writing. So I didn't write songs until I met Leonard, and then he said, why aren't you writing your own songs? And I said, I don't know, and started writing. But before that, I lived in the village. I moved directly to the village when I moved.
Remember how much you paid for rent?
$135.
I guess she does.
Was it a nice apartment for $135?
Yeah, it had one bedroom, but it was a nice, expansive.
Yeah.
It had enough room that I immediately bought my Steinway, on which I've written everything I've ever written, including
really?
The Blizzard and, you know, Since You've Asked and My Father and Secret Gardens and, I don't know, and The Moon Over the Hudson.
We assume this was a great, big, grand Steinway?
Yeah, it's not a 9 foot, but okay. It's a good size. It's a 6.5,
I think. That's pretty big.
And it still sounds like heaven. It's a great Steinway. And I've had a number of Steinways that have come in and out of my life. And I don't play, I play guitar, of course, but from Pete, early on, 63, 64, because we were both managed by Harold Levinthal.
Pete Seeger, you're talking about.
So I knew Pete very well, and I, in fact, spent a couple of hours with him the day he died at Columbia Presbyterian in New York. I was just home. There was like a little tiny window of time because I was on a six-week tour until about 2 days ago. And his grandson called me and said, you better get over here because he's going. And I was able to say goodbye. But I knew him very, very well, very well.
What was it like in the village? By the way, I went to law school. I applied to one law school, NYU, because I wanted to live in Greenwich Village.
Yes.
And what I would spend my non-studying times do is searching for Bob Dylan unsuccessfully. I didn't have as much success as you. It's a true story. What was it like when you moved there? What was the village like for people like you, Drew Collins?
It was incredible. You know, I saw that dreadful movie, a little piece of it. I couldn't stand to watch it. Llewellyn Davis. It's just so disgusting. I couldn't stand
why?
It.
Why?
It was depressing.
And why didn't you like it?
Oh, depressing. First of all, what is it? It's a piece of, first of all, it's a false representation of anything that was going on. There were a couple of good songs in it. That's it. It was so full of life and full of energy and full of dynamics. You know, Dave Van Ronk, about whom this terrible movie was supposed to be based, was hysterical. He was filled with passion. He was a storyteller. He was a great, great, great guy. Everybody, you know, yes, the war was going on, and that was the awfulest part, you know, protesting this hideous war in Vietnam, which we'll never get over. We'll never get over that. It's impossible. And it was terrible. But on the other hand, there was music and light and life, and every corner there was a little club, you know, there was the black pussycat, and there was
the bitter end,
and there was Gertie's Folk City, and Gertie's Folk City was where I landed the first time, and Bob was there. I had known Dylan in Colorado because he was scrambling around, you know, looking homeless and desperate and trying to get a job out there in the mountains, and he was in Cripple Creek, I think, singing at someplace. And came over to see me in the Bitter End at the Gilded Garter in Central City. So when I met him in New York, I'd already met him. I'd already known him as Mr. Zimmerman. And he was trying to find some place to really hang his hat most of the time. But everybody was there. Cisco was there. Peter, Paul, and Mary was there. Leonard.
Were you able to pay your $135 a month rent on
yes.
your singing then, or did you
yes.
have to do the waitressing thing?
Oh, I didn't waitress, and I didn't do basket
Okay.
Clubs. So no, I always made a living.
You made a living. And I'm just curious, for people that haven't seen Inside Llewyn Davis, was a big movie that you didn't like it. I'm glad, because I didn't like it either.
Hated
but the, it. But the prototype, the guy that was supposed to, that the movie was supposedly based on, why didn't he make it?
Oh, well, 95% of people who go into any business anywhere don't make it.
Even though he was pretty talented.
Yeah, I mean, why doesn't anybody, why are there certain people who do or who don't? There was a great, great cauldron of fabulous talent all coming together. That first night I was at Gertie's, Cisco Houston was there, Ramblin' Jack Elliott was there, Dave Van Ronk was there, Joan Baez, Mimi was down there. Farini was married to Carolyn Hester at that point. Carolyn was in New York. Peter, Paul, and Mary were not yet formed by Albert, but they soon would be. So they were singing around. I mean, it was just a boiling pot of politics and social change and music. And Pete was teaching children because he couldn't get a job anywhere else.
Because of the McCarthy, the communist association allegations.
With outrage and poetry.
Who captured, if that movie, and Marjorie did hate it, she came in saying, boy, was I horribly disappointed. I don't think she hated it as much as you. Well, so you're undecided on it? Is that what you're saying?
Judy my Collins. Family. Who? Express yourself.
Oh, I shouldn't have said Seeger, by the way. It wasn't communist allegation. It was that he refused to name names.
Yes.
And that's why he was blackballed.
Yeah.
House on American Activities Committee. Who best captured, either in print or in film, who best captured that moment in time?
There was a great writer whose name will come to me in a minute. Robert Shelton.
Okay.
Bob Shelton and another writer, who Jack Goddard, who wrote the Village Voice writers and the New York Times, always with Robert, always captured what was going on there beautifully. In film, I'm not sure. I can't really think of anything that has done justice to this. Maybe. The incarnation of the village itself. I understand now that there is, somebody just told me recently that there is a Broadway play now being developed called Gertie's Folk City, which was where it was all happening. This was an Italian restaurant run by a guy named Mike Porco, and my old manager, Charlie Rothschild, came into the club one night and said, "Listen, I want you to stop having quartets in here and accordion players. I'm going to bring in some folk singers because I think you need a change." So it was starting in like 55, and from then on, Mike Porco had a fabulous club in which everybody played. And we all went there. The Bitter End opened. Fred Weintraub opened the Bitter End. Also, everybody played there. So it was always bubbling. And then there was the Village Gate, Art DeLugoff's place. You just couldn't go around a block without finding folk music.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to get back to talking about all this excitement down in Greenwich Village. Yes, Jim?
Yeah, Judy Collins is going to stay with us for a couple minutes. And, you know, everything I read about Judy Collins says occasionally she just breaks into song. So who knows? Maybe. You never know. You can support great music with a gift of $150 right now. And we'll show our thanks with a pair of tickets to see who, Marjorie Egan?
To see Judy Collins.
This is the first chance to let WGBH say thanks for these great tickets. The show is definitely going to sell out. We will be there. It's Sunday, September 21st at the Great Wilbur Theater. We love the Wilbur Theater. If you got a call for this one, it's 888-897-9424. Again, it's 888-897-9424. And you have a couple of thank yous, Marjorie.
I do have some thank yous. We want to thank Anonymous in Sagamore Beach, Lisa in Worcester, Stephen in North Grafton, Kate in Acton. She's going to be joining Judy at the show next September as well. Zohar in Watertown, Cynthia in Boston, Mark in Cambridge, Susan in Newton, Beverly in Franklin. And we love to say thank you to 18 more people before the show is over. There is still time for a dollar match. It's on right now, so please call 888-897-9424, 888-897-9424.
We'll be back in a second with more Judy Collins at 89.7 WGBH.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed.
So I am in full swoon. That is All My Life by Judy Collins. I almost can't speak.
first of all, we have to say thank you for calling and giving your donation.
I know. Well, say it. Go ahead.
I love you, a bushel and a peck, a bushel and a peck, and a hug around the neck, hug around the neck, and a barrel and a heap, a barrel and a heap, and I'm talking about you in my sleep, or however it goes.
Okay, okay. Now we have to ask you.
I'm gonna pass
you
out.
You have a fantastic voice. Many people post 50 lose their voice. I assume you never smoke cigarettes.
Oh yes,
you did. Well, how, I mean, really, you know, when it, you're how do you keep your voice? I mean, it's unusual.
It is unusual. I'm very lucky. I have done everything in my power to keep what I was given, and it was a great gift at birth.
Yeah,
I was always a student, whether I was playing piano or learning to meditate or learning Russian when I went to Russia in 1965. And in 1965, I was already working so hard that I was having great problems with my voice, great problems. I would have further things that were even more serious, but this was definitely serious. And I found a teacher and I studied with him for 32 years.
Wow.
He was recommended by Harry Belafonte's guitarist, Ray Bogusloff, and also by a couple who ran an arts camp in the Berkshires, Morty and I forget their last name, but I'll think of it in a minute, Bauman, Morty and Irma Bauman, and they knew everything about everybody. And these people, unbeknownst to one another, both gave me the same name, and I called this man. I had his phone number in my purse. I was really in trouble. And I called him up and I said, you know, I had just moved from the village up to the Upper West Side because my therapist was on the Upper West Side.
It's always good to be close to your shrink. I'm with you, totally.
And I called him up and I said, you know, I've been told about you. Max Margulies was his name. And I've been told about you from a couple of sources. And I began to tell him about it. He said, you know, I don't really take any students. And I said, I begged and pleaded and whined, you know. And he said, well, maybe you should. So he said, I said to him, where do you live? And he gave me the address. And I walked out my front door, turned left past the elevator, and rang his bell.
Oh, gosh, that's great.
And I studied with him for...
And he gave you techniques.
He told me what to do.
Okay.
Why are you performing so much? I think it's great you do, and we're very excited. Well, I mean, you're going to be on the Wilbur. We mentioned September 21st.
I mean, what's so terrible about having to make a living?
Yeah.
But you do 100-plus shows a year. I would argue, not knowing your financial condition, that's probably more than you need to do.
Well, not really. You know, what's happened to the music industry is that we're all working, I think, at least two, sometimes three times as hard for the same money. That's what's happened.
Why?
No record labels.
Oh.
Everybody's on the road. And also there are certain times you go through. I mean, that's kind of the face of it. But the truth is that I would never give this up. I would never stop working. I don't intend to ever stop working. And I must have known that when I was very young because, you know, I have always tried to keep things. I was trained by classical pianists. A woman who was the first conductor in the world, actually, of symphony orchestras.
Wow.
And these people always get better at the end of their careers. So I think I always had that in my mind, too.
Are you better now?
Oh, yeah.
How are you better?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I'll find out on September
21st. Yes, you will.
Can
you write home about that and talk about it?
How are you better, Judy Collins?
I'm a better storyteller. I'm a better singer. I'm a better sport. I'm a better all-around. I mean, I really have something that's been given to me, which I've been working on and honing, but it involves a whole creative experience when I'm on stage.
When you're standing in front of 1,000, whatever number of people that are obviously adoring you, is it still as exciting as it was?
I break into In My Life. Oh, it's more exciting. It's much more. It's always been exciting, but it's what I need to stay on the planet. That's simply put, that's what I need to do to stay here.
And do you go, I always wonder when someone has written so many great songs and performed so many fabulous covers, when everybody's got a favorite, everybody's got a mountain of favorites. When you're performing, I know you tell stories and you talk a lot, so obviously there's this interactive thing. When someone yells out to sing something that you have sung, let's say Someday Soon, like Marjorie loves and has been playing nonstop.
Very romantic.
For the 4 millionth time.
Yeah.
Do you say to yourself, even if you don't, enough already, I've done this.
No.
Why? Because they love it or because you love it?
Because I love it and I can do it.
You know, you said it in interviews, and you were just alluding to it there, you want to be used up when you leave this mortal coil. You want to be done. And so I guess that's you're doing that now. But you've also, there was a great quote, I think it was an interview you might have given here on WGBH-TV, talking about some of your contemporaries, like the great Pete Seeger, who just passed away, mm-hmm. that if people that you grew up with in Greenwich Village, if they're not dead yet, they're thriving.
Yeah, so they're certainly working.
Yeah. So who else of the people that you were with as a young folk singer do you think are like bopping around all over the place like
you? Well, Joni's traveling all over the.
Joni Mitchell.
Joni Baez.
Mitchell doesn't do anything. Because Joni Mitchell's voice has been very affected by her smoking.
Yeah. Well, there are other things I think that impact us. You know, everybody is vulnerable at some point.
Yeah.
And you have to try to limit your vulnerability so that it doesn't wreck your life. And that's really the job of all of us, really. Oh, but there are a lot of people. I'm out on the road doing some shows with Don McLean in the past year.
Really?
And we have the best time. And he's cooking. He's singing. You know, he has a wonderful voice, and he's singing up a storm. And we just love it. But many, many singers.
Joan Baez, you've done a lot of work with her.
And Joan and I are old
duets.
Friends. We've done
a
couple of duets.
They did
one of Pete's songs, and then she and Mimi and I did a song called Linda Girlchild or something. I've never understood the song at all, so it's one of the few things I've ever sung that I couldn't tell you a thing about it.
One of the last, I saw a friend of mine runs Farm Aid, which I'm sure you're familiar with,
Willie Nelson's thing. Of course, Willie, I've been to Farm Aid.
You have? Mm. I was watching on streaming because I couldn't get there this year. Pete Seeger was there in, what was he, 93 or whatever he was at the time, and he does the final bit where all the board members come out. Nelson, Neil Young, Mellencamp, Dave Matthews. It was really one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen. I mean, Pete, give us a second on Pete Seeger for those.
A second. Where have all the flowers gone? When I do my shows now in the last 3 weeks since his death, I sing that song and the audience sings, and then in between I tell stories about my friendship with him, which goes back, you know, to 1961. We knew each other from that year. And we did concerts, of course, at Carnegie Hall. I was on the board of directors of Newport with him and with other people, Pete Seeger, Peter Yarrow and George Ween, of course. And so I've known him and I've visited him and we're friends and we celebrated our birthdays together because mine was the first, is the first, his is the third, and Theo Bicca was the second. So Harold would always throw us mutual parties together. The last time that my husband and I went up to, the last concert I saw him do was with Arlo in November 30th at Carnegie Hall. And Arlo said, you know, he probably can't sing. I mean, he can't certainly sing, but he will know the songs and he'll certainly sing along because he's written them all.
Now, I've read that you sing on your voicemail. So if I were to call Judy Collins, I get a song. What's the song?
I'll be seeing you in all your familiar places.
And boy, do we hope you do, Judy Collins.
We're almost out of time. You can give me a thumbs up, thumbs down. Was it fun dropping acid with Bob Dylan?
It was John Phillips and Michelle Phillips.
Oh, I thought it was Bob Dylan.
It could have been.
Was it fun? Who knows? Who knows?
Who knows? That's right.
So Judy Collins tonight on WGBH at 9 o'clock. Judy Collins live in Ireland. You can find out all her dates coming up, and she'll be back in Boston September 21st of the Wilbur. Judy, it was a pleasure having you.
Thank you.
Thanks
great
so
fun
much.
To be here. Yes. And contribute everybody.
Absolutely.
Thank
contribute
you.
Everybody. Thank
Please
you so
do.
Much for being with us.
Thank
Judy
you.
Collins. Am I introducing the show for tomorrow at this point? Again,
no, actually,
really sure.
What we're going to do is we're going to do a little pledge thing
in a second.
And then we will tell you what's coming up tomorrow. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay, thank you. I goofed.
And in the interim,
not
listen
unusual.
To In My Life yet again.
One person can make a big difference. But when a whole community comes together, amazing things can happen. And right now, when you support Boston Public Radio, amazing things will happen. That's because other listeners have gotten together and agreed to match your gift in any amount, dollar for dollar. But the match won't last long. Call 888-897-9424. The match also works online at wgbhnews.org.
And that number again, 888-897-9424. Here with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I'm Andy Hicks from WGBH's membership department. Judy Collins, how amazing was she?
She was great.
Just leaving.
It was a thrill.
Oh, so cool. It is easy to do your part online at WGBHnews.org or with a quick call to 888-897-9424. And this, by the way, dollar-for-dollar match, wrapping up the show today. Last chance to have your gift go twice as far with Jim and Marjorie. Jim, we got some names to thank. You love to do that.
Yeah, one person we should thank, by the way, is Judy Collins. During that brief break we took, she talked about being a contributor in New York City.
Judy,
public radio in the city is in New York City is a huge, huge part of her life. She's helping with fundraising tonight. And she is, by the way, a spectacular in person as she was for those
beautiful.
Of you listening out there.
She's she was beautiful.
Great.
She's
so we just amazing. Heard from Arlington and Dover. We want to thank Stephen and Chestnut Hill, Mary Beth and Newburyport. I love doing this. Tom and Roslindale, Ruth and Acton, Paul and JP, Jamaica Plain, and an anonymous caller in Needham, Mary Ellen in Tewksbury, and Diane in Amesbury. Thanks to all of you. We really, really appreciate it.
That's right, 888-897-9424. Again, just in the last few minutes of Jim and Marjorie's show today, I want to thank Judy Collins again, myself, for just singing I Love You a Bushel and a Peck to everybody who gave.
I know.
So cool.
I know. And if you had her phone number, you could get the answering machine and have her sing to you over the phone.
Aww.
Anyway, this is the last dollar-for-dollar match of this entire campaign, and it is sponsored by a generous member of the Ralph Lowell Society who's asked to remain anonymous. The Ralph Lowell Society, of course, is named after the founder of WGBH, and it's our major donor group here at WGBH. So I hope you'll be the next to continue the public broadcasting mission that Ralph Lowell started here in New England in 1951. And while you are at it, please take advantage of your last chance to have your gift matched dollar for dollar. Call 888-897-9424. 888-897-9424. Match is also good online at WGBH.org.
You know, one of the nice things about talking to Judy Collins, both on air and off, is you get to realize the broadest spectrum of people who both love and depend on public radio and television. It really is it's a sobering, wonderful thing. We've talked a lot about how you and I, long before we were lucky enough to work here, have been huge public radio fans, and actually be here is just spectacular. Here's the most important part of 89.7's March Community Campaign, the thank you. That's why the goal of this very short campaign is to send out 3,000 thank yous before it is all said and done. We both hope, and Andy does too, your name will be next. So does Judy Collins. Your name will be next on our thank you list. We've got people standing by to say thank you when you call, and it's 888-897-9424. And I only use it judging by myself. Do it now or you're going to forget. Call 888-897-9424 or keep a lookout for our thank you note after you give online at WGBHnews.org.
And again, in just the last 5 minutes or so of this program, we need to hear from 9 more people to stay on track. We'd love to thank 9 more people. And thank you to Francoise in Worcester for your support. Thank you for just checking in. Again, we want to remind you, you can support great music and great programming with a gift of $150. Right now, we'll show our thanks with a pair of tickets to see the one, the only Judy Collins. Your first chance to let WGBH say thanks with these great tickets. Very, very good seats at the Wilbur Theater, Sunday, September 21st. The show is so going to sell out, so please secure your seats now. You'll see Judy in person. You know, you just heard her. She still sounds great. She
sounds
fantastic.
Terrific.
She doesn't just sound great. Exactly like she sounds.
I know.
Sounded.
It's unbelievable.
I know.
So there are some really great incentives to get involved right now, but the real reason to get involved is because you believe in public broadcasting, that it helps get you through the day, get you through your commute, that it helps your family, your friends and neighbors do the same, that it's wonderful to listen to and to watch. We're getting close to the end of this March community campaign, so we really hope you will get involved right now. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing. There? Where else could you hear someone like Marjorie Egan say to Judy Collins, so what was it like dropping acid with Bob Dylan?
I read Bob Dylan.
No,
she said it was
great.
Peter, Paul, and Mary there, but maybe it was all four
no,
of them.
No, she didn't. She said it was Phillips and somebody else. And then she said, but pause, it could have been Bob
exactly.
Dylan.
I figured you drop one of those deals, you don't really know. know what's going on anyway.
Peter, Paul, and Mary, insert Puff the Magic Dragon joke here. And Marjorie,
that's
take it
right.
away.
Okay, right. So please take advantage of this dollar-for-dollar watch. The number, 888-897-9424, or give online at WGBHnews.org.
What's coming up tomorrow, Marjorie?
What's coming up tomorrow is historian Peniel Joseph is going to be here with his new book about Stokely Carmichael, which is fantastic. Alex Beam joins us, as he always does on Thursdays, for Open Mic. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. Thank you all for tuning in to listen to me and Jim. And thank you again for taking the time to contribute to WGBH News and WGBH Radio and Television. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy, and we are getting emails saying, when did you say her Live in Ireland special is? It's 9 o'clock tonight on Channel 2, Judy Collins, Live in Ireland. And as I said, I'm Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan. Again, thank you for tuning in, and thanks for contributing to WGBH.